Okay. Good morning. Thank you so much. Welcome back. Okay. Well, the topic for this morning's shiur is something which relates to Shavuos and also a certain aspect with regard to the halachas of gerus, of conversion, which, as we know, plays an important role in regard to the holiday of Shavuos. Shavuos, to a large extent, celebrates the conversion of Chal Yisrael. The halachas that we know about conversion nowadays are learned down from how Chal Yisrael received the Torah at Shavuos. And there's also a tie-in between conversion and Shavuos because of the conversion of Ruth HaMoaviyah, of Ruth, which clearly also is an integral part of our celebration of Yom Tov. There's a particular aspect of the story of Ruth that I want to try to touch upon today to explain something which, on the surface, when we go through Megillas Ruth, is somewhat hard to understand. And we're going to go through and try to analyze that through the prism of the story that took place in Yerushalayim in 1848. So let's go back to Yerushalayim 1848. We'll learn about an interesting incident that took place at that time. And through that story, we'll come to perhaps have a little bit of a different, a renewed understanding of something that takes place in the Megillas Ruth. In 1848, there was a fellow in Yerushalayim who was Megayer, who converted with one of the Basi Din in Yerushalayim. Apparently, he was uncircumcised, you know, prior to, you know, to converting, so he had a full-fledged bris milah, full-fledged circumcision. We know that for a man, there are two aspects which the person has to undergo in order to convert. He has to have a bris milah for the purposes of conversion, and then after that he has to go into a mikvah. If the person is already circumcised, so that's one of those things he can only do once, so he doesn't have a full-fledged circumcision, he has to cut off the tambris, where the moel simply removes a drop of blood from that area for the purposes of fulfilling the mitzvah of milah. In this particular case, the fellow had a full-fledged bris milah, and he was awaiting his tevilah. Between the time that the fellow had his circumcision and the time that he was scheduled to go to the mikvah, Shabbos fell out. In other words, whatever the dates were exactly, let's say he had his bris on a Tuesday, and he needed a couple of days to heal, so they're only planning the immersion for the following Sunday or Monday. So there was a Shabbos that took place between his circumcision and his immersion. So the Shabbos came up in Yerushalayim in 1848 as follows. What exactly is this fellow's status? The halacha is that although there's a discussion in the Gemara about what exactly is considered to be necessary for conversion, we paskin that these two steps, both circumcision and immersion, are absolutely necessary for the conversion to be considered to be valid. And the conclusion was added by the Gemara is that a person who undergoes circumcision but not immersion is not Jewish at all. In other words, he has to undergo the immersion and the mikvah before he can become fully Jewish. So what's the status of this fellow? On the surface, although he's halfway there, he's had the circumcision but not the immersion, and although, let's be honest, of the two requirements, the circumcision was definitely the harder requirement as opposed to jumping into the mikvah, nonetheless, you know, it ain't over till it's over. One would think that he's still a non-Jew at this point. Oh, if he's a non-Jew, so we know that Gemara tells us that a non-Jew is not supposed to keep Shabbos, right? Shabbos is a special gift which is given to the Jewish people. It's a sign of our intimate relationship which we have with the Ribbono Shel Olam. So the Gemara goes so far as to make the statement that a non-Jew who keeps Shabbos is high mitzvah, is subject to a divine penalty of death. It doesn't mean that the person takes him out and stones him, but it does mean that it's really an inappropriate thing for a non-Jew to be keeping Shabbos. Shabbos is the exclusive province of the Jewish people, and you know, a non-Jew is kind of cutting in on the party if he comes and keeps Shabbos. So now all of Yerushalayim was debating what this fellow should be doing. On the one hand, he's a day or two away from becoming Jewish. He already started the process. He had a bris milah. Right? So you're going to tell this guy, who probably by that time already I imagine, was probably dressing like a Yerushalmi Yid, you know, fellow off into shul. That Shabbos, with the shtrabel and, you know, the long zechusah that the Yerushalmi Jews, you know, wear to this day. And you got to tell the guy that he can't keep Shabbos? Doesn't sound quite right. But on the other hand, again, it's not over until it's over. So he goes to the mikveh, he's not Jewish. So there was debating back and forth what to do. The Rav of Yerushalayim at that time was the very famous of Shmuel Salant, who was well known as being the longtime Rav of Yerushalayim throughout the 1800s into the early 1900s. He had an unusually long career as the Rav of Yerushalayim, of Shmuel Salant. It's actually an interesting story that of Shmuel Salant. He was getting to be a little bit older. Passed away into his 90s, so he was getting to be a little bit older. I think he was about 70. And the Yerushalayim Kehillah came to him and said, you know, Rebbe, maybe we should hire an assistant. You know, the Rav's getting a little bit older. You know, maybe he needs somebody else to help him out. They hired an assistant. The assistant predeceased the Shmuel Salant. He kept going, right? They have photographs of the Shmuel Salant. He lived into the early 1900s. So right before the last month of his life, a British journalist came to Eretz Yisrael, to Palestine at that time, and had an audience with the elderly of Shmuel Salant. He snapped a photograph of Shmuel at that particular time. So we have the photograph. And, you know, he describes, this British non-Jewish journalist describes, you know, I was in the presence of this holy man, the great Rabbi Salant, you know, of Jerusalem, and he describes the feelings that he had, that he was in the presence of somebody great. So again, the Rav Yerushalayim at that time was with Shmuel Salant, so you figure, okay, you know, he's the perfect person to weigh in and make a decision as to whether this fellow should dafka keep Shabbos, because he's halfway to being a convert, or whether he should dafka break Shabbos, because he's still considered to be a non-Jew. The only problem was, the Shmuel Salant was on sabbatical. That's what happens when he gives the rabbi a sabbatical. He was away. So there was another very chashuv Talmud Chacham who was filling in for a Shmuel Salant as the Rav Yerushalayim. But, okay, so, you know, the great Shmuel Salant was not there. So they went to the substitute and they asked him, what should we do? The substitute Rav is thinking to himself, gee, I wish the Shmuel Salant was back in town, so he could pop in the Shaira. But after thinking about it, the substitute Rav said, look, the Gemara says this fellow is not Jewish, so not Jewish is not Jewish. I don't care that in 2 days he's going to be Jewish. I don't care that he's walking around with a shtrabel and that he looks like all the rest of us. Not Jewish is not Jewish. So they tell the guy, after Mincha Shabbos afternoon, you should write two letters on a piece of paper to be Mechalel Shabbos. And, you know, that way you won't be in violation of the non-Jew keeping Shabbos. So that's what happened. You know, after Mincha Shabbos afternoon, everybody else went to Shabbos Shudas. He pulled out his quill and, you know, wrote down two letters. And, okay, that was the story. After Shabbos, you can imagine that the discussion didn't go away. Right? You can imagine what everybody you saw I was talking about over Malava Malcolm. You know, I'm sure everybody had an opinion this way, that way. Was the right thing? Was the wrong thing? How could you do that? You know, Jews tend to be opinionated, you know, about a lot of things. So everybody was weighing in one way or the other. They should have made him do it. They shouldn't have made him do it. But they decided, you know, let's send off the Shiloh to the great postkin in Europe and let's see what they say. What's that? Yes, well after the fact. Again, they couldn't text the postkin in Europe, you know. So again, these were, you know, they had to make a decision on the spot of the Shabbos. There wasn't much they could do. But they were so, you know, they really wanted to know what's the right answer over here. So it's interesting, right? I mean, nowadays, you know, somebody had a really great Shiloh, probably the Shiloh would make its way there to Israel eventually. In Eretz Yisrael in 1848, the really great Shilohs were sent back to Europe because the community in Eretz Yisrael was relatively small at that particular point in time. So they sent off the Shilohs to various posts in Europe. Basically, what should we have done under the circumstances? The vast majority of posts who got the letter basically said that if we had been asked, we would have said that the fellow should not have been Mechalel Shabbos. under those circumstances. What was the reasoning behind that? So the various poskim gave various different reasons. Let me share one reason that was given by Yaakov Esslinger, who was the major posek in Germany at that time, the Binyan Sion. Actually very interesting, right? In other words, when they had a shaila in Yerushalayim in 1848, they sent it off to Germany for a psak, right? You see how the world has changed since 1848. But with Yaakov Esslinger, Rav Etlinger was the Rav of Rav Shmuel Paul Hirsch. He was Rav Hirsch's Rebbe. So again, big posek, wrote many sparim on Shas, poskim, and the like. So Yaakov Etlinger made the following interesting argument. He said, we can argue from history that this fellow shouldn't have been Machal Shabbos. What's the historical argument? So said Yaakov Etlinger, when did the Jews first get the mitzvah of Shabbos, historically? Right? So, they did not get it first at Har Sinai, right? Right? Chazal tell us that when the Jews had already left Mitzrayim, and they came to a place called Morah, right? The place where the waters were bitter, and Moshe Rabbeinu was instructed by the Ribbono Shel Olam to take some kind of a tree to put it into the water and to sweeten the waters in Marah. At that point, Shom Lo Choku Mishpat, Shom Nisohu, at that point the Ribbono Shel Olam revealed various mitzvahs to Moshe Rabbeinu to teach to the Jewish people. One of them was Shabbos. Right? There used to be a Mordechai Ben David song, Chukol Seha B'mara Nitzavu B'Azhara. I mean, he didn't write the words, he wrote the tune, right? But I think it's in Ibn Ezra who has the those words, Chukol Seha B'mara Nitzavu B'Azhara. The laws of Shabbos were taught to the Jewish people at Mara, right? And, you know, certainly even before Har Sinai, the Jewish people were given the mitzvah of Shabbos. More than that, if you look, you know, the idea that Chal Yisrael got the mitzvah of Shabbos at Mara is a medrash of Chazal. But if you look in the psukim of the Torah itself, you see that Shabbos was given to the Jewish people prior to Matan Torah. When Chal Yisrael are in the Midbar and they get the Mon, which again is all before Matan Torah, the Chumash itself tells us how Chal Yisrael were told by the Ribbono Shel Olam, you know, that there's this thing called Shabbos, and on Shabbos the mon is not going to fall, so you're going to get a double portion, as we know, on Friday. Right? So in other words, the idea of Shabbos was already revealed to the Jewish people at least twice prior to Matan Torah. Says Rav Yaakov Etlinger, what was the nature of the status of the Jewish people when Shabbos was revealed to them? Well, we know that the Jewish people, in order to come tachat kantei hashchina, in order to fully become Jewish, in order to engage in the national conversion process, just like males do today, had to have a double faceted process in order to become Jewish. They had to engage in milah, and they had to engage in tevilah, an immersion in the mikvah. When did the Jewish people have circumcision? Back in Mitzrayim, right? We know that before they ate the Korban Pesach, the males were all circumcised. When did Klal Yisrael go to the mikvah? So when they came to Har Sinai, right? The Pasuk says that when the Jews come to Har Sinai, they should immerse their garments. And the Gemara says that they had to immerse their garments in order to purify the garments. They certainly had to immerse themselves. It wouldn't make sense to purify their garments and not their persons. So they went to mikvah right before getting the Torah. They had bris milah from the time that they were in Mitzrayim. So it comes out that Rav Yaakov Etlinger, when the Jews historically got the mitzvah of Shabbos, they were exactly in the same state of being as our friend in Yerushalayim. They were individuals who had undergone bris milah, but had not yet gone to the mikvah. So said Rav Yaakov Etlinger, if the Jews leaving Egypt could get Shabbos and could be expected to keep Shabbos when they were in that in-between stage, having undergone bris milah, but not having yet gone to mikvah, so that should prove to us that somebody nowadays who's in an analogous kind of situation, someone who, on a personal level, has had the bris milah but has not yet had an immersion in a mikvah, there's no reason why he shouldn't be able to keep Shabbos as well. What's the logic behind that? So, same with Yaakov Edlin there. You know, why is it that Shabbos is set aside for the Jewish people and a non-Jew is not allowed to keep Shabbos? He said, well, Shabbos is a sign of the bris, the special covenant that exists between Klal Yisrael and the Ribono Shel Olam. He owes he, you know, Vein B'nei Yisrael, owes he Le'olam. Right? Between myself and the Jewish people, Shabbos is an eternal sign. It's a bris. It's a covenant between Klal Yisrael and the Ribono Shel Olam. A non-Jew is not part of that bris. He's not part of that covenant, so he can't really connect to Shabbos and everything it represents. However, to Rabbi Yaakov Edlinger, the minute someone has undergone circumcision, so that already creates a degree of covenant. I mean, we call it a bris milah. It's a covenant of circumcision. He's come into the covenant by virtue of going through the process of circumcision, of bris milah. So once he's part of the bris by virtue of his circumcision, he should be able to be part of the bris by virtue of his observance of Shabbos as well. In other words, once, you know, he may not be, he's in an interesting state. He may not be Jewish, but he's part of the covenant the Jewish people has with God by virtue of the bris, by virtue of his circumcision. And that covenant that he's already entered into is enough to enable him to keep Shabbos. He's not like, you know, a non-Jew off the street. He's, you know, come into the covenant up until a point. Along these same lines, there's a tshuva from the Minchas Luzer, the Minchas Rebbe, who, you know, was the Rebbe in Munkach prior to the war. So the Minchas Rebbe was asked about the following scenario. A fellow was in the process of converting, and he had his bris milah, and unfortunately, before he was able to go to the mikvah, the fellow passed away. So the shaila was, where do you bury him? We know that ordinarily Jews are supposed to be buried with Jews, and non-Jews are supposed to be buried with non-Jews. In other words, you know, somebody who has Kedushas Yisrael, who has the status of being Jewish, is supposed to be buried among Jews. So how about this guy? Where does this guy fall out? You know, he... What's that? Yeah, right. So it doesn't... Right. So the problem is we sort of have to trouble him while he's alive in order for it to work. Right? So, you know, this guy had the misfortune of passing away, you know, at a very inconvenient time, you know, sort of in this interim stage. So where do you put him? So the Minchas Rebbe said he could be buried in a Jewish cemetery with everybody else. Halachically, he's not Jewish. He didn't go to the mikvah. So the answer is, said the Minchas Rebbe, yeah, okay. He may not be halachically Jewish, but by undergoing the circumcision, he already cast his lot with the Jewish people. He's become part of the covenant of the Jewish people, even though he hasn't sealed the deal, so to speak. And as such, that's already enough to enable him to be buried in a Jewish cemetery, because he's become part of the covenant of the Jewish people and can become, you know, part of, you know, that qualifies him, you know, to be buried together with the rest of the Jews. That I don't know. I don't know. But to put him in a Jewish cemetery, that they're certainly allowed to do. No, so again, so that's what he's saying. In other words, you're right, he's not Jewish. But to be buried in a Jewish cemetery just means that you've entered into the covenant of being Jewish. It's an interesting... He isn't Jewish. In other words, you can't count him in a minion. Right? In other words, you can't count him in a minion. You can't, you can't eat a shrita, you know. Well... Right, so the Gemara would have said that despite the fact that he's not Jewish, but he can still keep Shabbos, because Shabbos is a function, again, it's a novel way of looking at it, Shabbos is a function of his being part of the Jewish covenant, right? He's sort of like, if you will, an associate member, you know? He's part of the covenant of the Jewish people, even though he's not actually Jewish, you know, in a halakhic sense. So that's a very interesting idea that, you know, again, the Munkash has developed along the same lines as with Yaakov Edlinger. Okay, so that was Rabbi Yaakov Edlinger's approach to this whole issue. And again, that was typical of many, many of the answers that were sent back to Yerushalayim. You know, basically all these Gedolim in Europe more or less said, you know, if we would have been there in Yerushalayim at the time, we would not have made him, you know, write these two letters, you know, between Mincha and Mayer. Again, you know, it was a little late at that point, but, you know...
Did they ask what
It's interesting. So as far as I know, I'm not sure what he actually weighed in when he did come back. Yeah, yeah. Right. The political correct thing to do is never get involved when your substitute rabbi already issued a psak, you know. So he probably ducked the question. So a number of years ago, the menahel at Yeshiva University, Yeshiva Sadeh Yitzchak Elchanan, his Bun Chalav, wrote an article where he suggested an approach to this question, a very, very novel approach, based on a comment made by the Rokin Shavar Gon in his commentary Megillas Rus. The Rokin Shavar was Yosef Rosen, was the Lubavitcher Chassid, who was one of the Rabbonim in Dzinsk in Latvia in the early part of the 20th century. Dzinsk in Latvia had two very, very chashuv Rabbonim in the beginning of the 20th century. There was Rav Meir Simcha of Dzinsk, the Or Sameach, the Meshech Chachma. He was the Rav for the non-Hasidic community in Dzinsk. And the Rogachov served as the Rav for the Hasidic community. He was personally Lubavitcher Chassid. And, you know, he was in Dzinsk at the same time as Rav Meir Simcha. The Rogachov was renowned as being one of the most brilliant Talmidei Chachamim of the generation. Literally just, you know, was known to know Shas on his fingertips. And people used to, much the same way they do Yigod L'chai with L'chaim Kanievsky today, people would send him postcards with questions, and he would send back the same postcard with like a three-word answer that would answer, you know, the entire question that had been posed to him. You know, he was a brilliant person in almost like a frightening fashion as to how just incredibly brilliant he was. So in his comments to Megillas Rus, the Rogatchev raises the following question, a very, very basic question in Megillas Rus. When exactly did Rus convert? We know that Megillas Rus is a lot about Rus's conversion to Judaism. When exactly did that take place? So if you ask the average person, right, if you would go out here on Grand Street, flag down random people and ask them, when did Rus convert? So some of most people would tell you the following. You know, after Rus was widowed of her husband Machlon, and Naomi told her that, you know, I'm going back to Eretz Yisrael, you know, you might as well stay here in Moab. And Rus eventually says to Naomi, no, I'm going with you. Amech Ami Velokayach Elokai, your nation is my nation, your God is my God. Right? Presumably that's the point at which she converts, or at the very least, that's the point at which she expresses her desire to convert. You know, I don't know how many bucket din there were in Moab at that time that she could have converted with, but the two of them go off together there to Israel. Maybe there they found the desert, but like sometime around that period of time, you know, at the end of Perek Aleph, is where Rus actually converts. So that's the Rogatchev, but wait a minute. If we're going to assume that, then there's a basic problem with the storyline of the Megillah, right? Fast forward to Perek Dalet in the Megillah, right? Rus has come to Boaz at the end of Perek Gimel, and Rus says to Boaz, I know that you're Mishpacha with Naomi, and you know, as such, I'd like you to marry me, because I'm Mishpacha also. I was married to Machlon. So Boaz says, it's a nice idea, but there's a relative who's even a closer relative than I am. He has to have first dibs, so to speak, as to whether to marry you or not. Okay, so Terezala describes how they approach this individual, and the individual is asked, will he marry Rus, the widow of Machlon? We know that he turns down the offer, and therefore Boaz, who's the next in line, you know, who's also a relative to Machlon, is the one who ultimately marries Rus. After Rogatchev, wait a minute. That whole scenario assumes that Rus and Machlon were halachically married. Wait a minute. If Rus wasn't Jewish, then she wasn't married to Mahlon at all. Right? I mean, again, maybe they had a civil marriage or something. You know, they went to a justice of the Moabite peace, you know. Maybe they were married in court, you know, City Hall or something like that. But halakhically, that has no ramifications. We know that if a Jew and a non-Jew, Rachmana Litzlan, get married, so it has no meaning halakhically whatsoever. They're not considered to be married. There is no way halakhically that a Jew and a non-Jew can be married. So the whole premise of Megillus Ruth is that Mahlon and Ruth were married, because otherwise, you know, what's Boaz saying? Well, you know, we have to go to this other relative. He has an obligation to marry Ruth because he's a close relative to Mahlon, and if that doesn't go through, I'm also a relative to Mahlon, so I'll marry you. It's all irrelevant. If she wasn't Jewish, there's no degree of connection whatsoever. So I don't understand, says the Rav Shaffer. So obviously she converted before she married Mahlon. But if she converted before she married Mahlon, so then what's the whole discussion that she has with Naomi? Why does Naomi say to her, well, you know, stay here in Moab, you don't have to come back with me? What do you mean you don't have to come back with me? You're Jewish. You know, you've got to come back there to Israel and keep the mitzvahs. What are you going to do here in Moab all by yourself? So the story itself is incredibly ambiguous. When did Ruth actually convert? You know, the story doesn't read well if she converted before she married Mahlon, and the story doesn't read well if she converted after Mahlon had already passed away. So how do you make head or tails out of the story? Comes the Rav Shaver, and he offers up, excuse me, turn that off, sorry about that, comes the Rav Shaver, and he offers up the following fascinating interpretation. Again, only the Rav Shaver with his brilliance can come up with the following idea. Says the Rav Shaver, there's a concept in conversion such that a conversion can be effective retroactively. Let's say, let's understand how this works in the context of Rus. Says the Rav Shaver, it's inconceivable that Ruth would have married Mahlon without any conversion whatsoever. I mean, again, right? Okay, but somebody would have cared. In other words, you know, Naomi just let, you know, her son marry a totally non-Jewish woman. It doesn't. Doesn't sound palatable. Right. So they were wrong. I mean, we'll see in a moment. I mean, we're definitely not trying to justify what they did. But again, it's very strange to imagine that they just married, you know, somebody who was not Jewish at all. So says the Rav Shaver, what probably happened is as follows. Ruth went through a lackluster conversion to marry Mahlon. A quickie conversion. Right? In other words, they went through the motions, Ruth went to mikvah, and, you know, they officially had a Jewish ceremony and all of that. But it was lacking one of the basic aspects of conversion, which is Kabbalah Tol Mitzvah, that the convert has to accept the Yoke of Torah Mitzvah. Nah, she went, you know, they put together an ad hoc Thanksgiving, they had a quickie conversion, she went to mikvah, they had a chuppah, you know, Shalom al Yisrael, you know, and all was good. So it wasn't the conversion that we would consider to be a valid conversion, because the Kabbalah Ol Mitzvah was lacking. However, it was there were certain elements of conversion that she underwent. Namely, she went to mikvah for the purposes of converting. Now, she may not have done everything right. She didn't have a Kabbalah Ol Mitzvah, an acceptance of the mitzvah. But she did do an activity. She did an action which is associated with conversion. Now, fast forward. She goes. She's talking to Naomi. And Naomi says, you know, you really don't have to come back with me to Eretz Yisrael. You can stay here in Moab. No, I want to go back with you. Fine, but realize you have to, if you want to come back with me, you have to be a full-fledged Jew, which means that you have to accept the mitzvah. Says Rosh Amech Ami Velokayach Elokar, your nation is my nation, your God is my God. In other words, she accepts the mitzvah right then and there. Says the Rav Shaver, now that she accepted mitzvah, the immersion in the mikvah which she did retroactively becomes her conversion. So in other words, until she accepted mitzvahs, when she immersed in the mikvah, it wasn't good enough, because she immersed in the, she had the immersion in the mikvah, but she was lacking that second piece of accepting the yoke of mitzvahs. Right? So again, she hadn't done the whole deal. She had done part of the conversion process, but it wasn't sufficient. But once she put into place the second aspect of the conversion process, i.e. the acceptance of the yoke of mitzvahs, that reignited the immersion retroactively, and she was retroactively considered to be Jewish from before her marriage to Machlon. So basically what the Rabbi Shaver is saying is that, again, in a brilliant interpretation, a very novel interpretation, but a brilliant interpretation, basically you can have your cake and eat it too. In other words, when did she convert? You know, she converted when she made the decision to go with Naomi back to Eretz Yisrael, and that decision then made her Jewish retroactively from even before her marriage to Machlon. That solves the problems, because on the one hand, what she did with Machlon was wrong, right? In other words, Machlon married a woman who had gone through the motions of conversion, but had not committed to an observant lifestyle, so it wasn't considered to be a good conversion. So we properly fault Machlon and Kilyon for having married, you know, non-Jewish woman at the time. You know, their conversion was lackluster, and therefore, you know, they were not really considered halachically to be Jewish. But the minute Ruth took upon herself, you know, I really want to keep the mitzvahs properly, she then was considered to be a convert retroactively, and retroactively she became Machlon's wife from a halachic perspective. Again, an incredibly tremendous chiddush of the Rabbi Shaver, that, you know, the marriage... What's that?
It seems like it's a grasping time.
Right, but the problem is you're still left with all the kashas and the gilas rus. Meaning, in other words, if we... Okay, no, but we have to make the psukim understandable. In other words, if the psukim are describing her halachically as being the wife of Machlon, it means that her marriage to Machlon had halachic significance. How do you understand that if she didn't convert properly? That's the Rav Shaver says. We can have our cake and eat it too. She converted properly later, but in a way that ignited retroactively the immersion that she did and sort of breathed new halachic life into her marriage to Machlon.
Because, you know, that's one of the
low down
for, and in the minute that she did that, he was
caught. I'm not going to venture an opinion about where Machlon ended up, but consider the following. If a person does something which at the time is an Aveira, the Avera is not removed retroactively, right? In other words, the Gemara says that even if the Gemara says as follows, right? I decide I'm going to go out and eat a cheeseburger. Right? I'm not recommending this, right? But I go out and decide I'm going to eat a cheeseburger. So I go and buy a cheeseburger, and, you know, full of rebellion against the Rebbe, I invite it to the cheeseburger, and somebody takes the story and says, oh, that's one of those glatt kosher make-believe cheeseburgers. Ah, yeah, with, you know, tofu cheese and tofu meat and tofu bread and, you know, alligator. I should say, wait a minute, but I wanted to have a straight cheeseburger. I didn't want to have a kosher cheeseburger. So do I get an Aveira? So the Gemara says, I get an Aveira. Right? Because in my mind, I thought it's not as bad an Aveira as if I actually ate the cheeseburger. But if in my mind I was doing something which I thought was an Aveira, so I get punished for that, you know? So if Machlon, you know, you can't fully rehabilitate Machlon, because Machlon certainly at the time was doing something which was wrong, right? But what we can rehabilitate is we can rehabilitate the status that Ruth had at that particular time.
Hi, I wanted to say hi. I'm a guy from the Lower Side Jewish Conservancy, and I'm part of a group to take a look at the shul. I wanted to just mention to you, one of my grandchildren, who was at the Chabad, went to school, the pre-K in Chabad in Connecticut, he was, they taught about Shmuz, of course, and holidays. I was over in their house. Excuse my interruption. I was over in their house in the Shabbat.
Yeah.
And I was telling the children, you know, that it's traditional to have dairy on Shabbat. Dairy products and cheesecake and things like that. So this little 4-year-old said, so we can have cheeseburger?
Okay. So, yeah.
Again, they were
so right.
They should not have to go through an Orthodox conversion again.
Right. So we would not hold that halacha l'maisa. Let me just be very clear. In other words, we would make the person go through another conversion. Right. And that happens not infrequently. But it would come out according to this Rogatchover, which again, we would not accept halacha l'maisa. It would come out for this Rogatchover that perhaps the going to the mikvah, which they had originally, could be rehabilitated once in the Kabbalah mitzvah. Right, which is a tremendous kiddush, and again, we would not hold that in practical terms. Don't go out and convert anyone based on the shir, but I'm just saying, from a theoretical point of view, the idea of the Rogatchover is fascinating. Right, so the Rogatchover is saying, again, this tremendous, tremendous kiddush, that conversion has the ability of working retroactively up to a point. Right.
So then,
wouldn't
he have
taught
maybe
for
conversion real?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not trying to figure out where Machlon is now. You know, that's not my issue. But okay. It's hard to imagine that, you know, they really thought that living a non-observant life, you know, would be a good thing. You know, and that, you know, again, I don't know. But, yeah. Right, but in other words, what the Rogatchover is assuming is that there was a tevila without Kabbalah Talmud, which basically meant that, you know, she was Jewish in name, but, you know, they weren't really doing everything. Okay. Maybe, right. I mean, where would she have learned them from? Right. Clearly she was a person of tremendous stature, but how does she know? Machlon comes to her and says, you're going to be Jewish. What does that mean? Well, you know, we have cream cheese and lox, you know, we have all kinds of good things. And, if that's what it is, fine, okay. You're Knebelach, okay, Knebelach sounds good, right, okay, I'll sign up, right? I don't know. So, with this Rogatchover, it says, come back to our case in Yerushalayim in 1848. So again, we're wondering about this scenario, this fellow who had a bris milah but had not yet gone to the mikvah, what should his status be with regard to Shabbos? Just Rabbi Chama, based on this Rogatchover, if we accept this Rogatchover, so it means that when a person completes their conversion, they actually become Jewish, not at that moment, but they become Jewish retroactively from the first stage in their conversion process. Rus was Mekabel Ol Mitzvahs and then became Jewish retroactively from the time she went to Mikvah. Argues Rabbi Chalav, it should come out that when our fellow goes to Mikvah, he becomes Jewish retroactively from the time that he has the Bris Milah. Now, if that's the case, you can never tell a guy to be Mechal Shabbos, even if he's not Jewish now, but if he's going to become Jewish retroactively in a few days, so it comes out that certainly you wouldn't tell such a person to be Mechal Shabbos. So nowadays we tell people that they should keep Shabbos from the time that they have the Bris Milah. Usually it takes about 4 weeks to heal properly. You know, nowadays, I don't know if they did Yerushalayim in 1848. Nowadays, they do dissolving stitches. I'm pretty sure they did not do that in Yerushalayim in 1848. So, no, so it has to be done in that order. So, the kisser, so, you know, here you have this interesting, interesting shiloh that came up in 1848 where an analysis of Megillas Rosh may give us a unique perspective on that particular shiloh.
Written on two letters.
Yeah.
Would you have burned somewhere in your head?
Again, I don't know.
I don't know how these.
No, because the Gemara says that a non-Jew is not allowed to keep Shabbos. Right.
He
can consider himself whatever he wants, but I mean, it goes from there. Yeah, I mean, again, the lashon of the Gemara is Nachrish Shabbat Chayiv Misa. So whatever that means exactly, you know, it's dead. In other words, you know, we should do whatever we can to instruct a non-Jew not to keep Shabbos fully, right? So in other words, it's better for his spiritual health that he write those two letters. So that's what the Rav of Yerushalayim at the time asked him. Right. Yeah, you should do one thing. One thing to be Machal Shabbos. Right?
But even if he wouldn't
have written those letters, you know, I mean, even if, let's say, the Rav wouldn't have written the Enes, would still have been,
you know, what
Rabbi.
You have to go with what
the Rav
tells you at the time.
Right. Again, I don't. I don't. You know, right. He followed the staff. He went to the Rav, so I followed the staff. You know.
Okay.
So. If he asked the Shiloh, that was the fact that he was given. Al-Kapar is a fascinating idea that we see in Megillus Rosh, you know, again, controversial. I'm not saying that we would accept this in practical terms, but certainly a fascinating idea, the notion that the conversion could work in a retroactive fashion. And, you know, again, it's a fascinating way of looking at a basic question in the Megillas Rus that otherwise is very, very hard to understand. This, Beth Hashem, is our last shiur for the season. Sorry, okay. But June? I don't know. The truth is, I mean, next week is Memorial Day. A lot of people go away. Then there's a brunch, and you know, like a graduation. There's a Bas Yaakov thing, I think. Right? So, but we should enjoy that. Perhaps we'll have the opportunity over the summer a little bit to schedule sporadically some shiur. So we'll let everybody know. Yeah. Yeah.